League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Let's talk.
John Brown. The Prime Ministerial Court. In the Prime Ministerial Court, Professor Rod Rhodes provides a thorough depiction of the court politics of the Conservative governments of the 21st century, namely the courts of David Cameron, Theresa May, and Boris Johnson. A fascinating look into a, should we call it a memorable period of British political history? Delighted to say that Professor Rob Rhodes joins us live on the line now. Good morning to you, Prof. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
We're only 24 years into the 21st century, and yet, the subtitle is Conservative Statecraft in the 21st Century. Well, might one argue that you know, Stalin had a better handle on statecraft than some of the conservative prime ministers we've had thus far in the 21st century?
I have to say, I started this book it was absolutely straight academic book, thinking, how can I make this a little less boring than my academic books usually are? But I needn't have worried, because the Conservative government came to my rescue with the shenanigans which followed after 2010. I mean, I never thought of myself as being naive.
Right.
I actually thought I knew quite a bit about politics. But as it went on, I became more and more surprised at how awful it was becoming. And then it suddenly struck me, yes, it was becoming more awful, but it had always been awful. That all of this started back with David Cameron. There's nothing new about it. And what was really scary was the fact that it was just taken for granted that this was how you ought to behave. I still struggle with that idea.
It's called court politics. Now, yes. which brings to mind to me, obviously, I'm thinking, you know, Tudor stroke Stuart stroke, you know,
right.
whispered alliances, skullduggery in dark corners, etc. And really, and people, a certain section of my listenership will now be throwing their Cafe Con lectures at the wireless, going, oh, for goodness sake, he's going off on a lefty bend again. But it's... it happens, trust me. But when you look at perhaps the way that certain elements of the Conservative government acted, we were harking back to a bygone age. And when people say, oh, we want to go back to we want our country back. Yeah, we want our country. Perhaps we do want our country back, but we certainly don't want a Jacobean country back, do we?
No, we don't. I mean, I think there are days when I think that all that's changed is that we have replaced the swords with mobile phones.
Right. Well, in a way of sort of bloodletting and silencing.
Right. I mean, we kill people with gossip on mobile phones nowadays rather than beheading them.
Okay, fair enough. Off to the tower you go, or I'll just look at your WhatsApps. Here's the thing, you're looking at specific areas. It's not just a sort of casting, there's a broad sweep over the book, yes. But you're looking at certain specific topics, including the courtiers. Now,
yes.
Are we looking at, so presumably chief courtier in this particular one would be Dominic Cummings, for example?
Yes. But it was by no means the first. If you go back to 2010 and to David Cameron, I mean, nobody remembers the newspapers from 2010, but they were talking about the Cameroons. Yeah. And there being sort of a group of people at the top who David Cameron's mates, they all lived together, they partied together, and they were the first batch of courtiers for the Conservative governments of the 21st century. It's continued all the way through. I mean, the difference is David Cameron had got a really good set of people with him. I think people like Llewellyn and Kate Fall were disciplined, organised, and kept Cameron's world at least relatively under control. Theresa May, who was presiding over, frankly, anarchy within the Conservative Party, coped with that simply by being secretive and having the smallest court of the three. And Johnson, I mean, whilst he had what everybody likes to talk about as sort of the key courtier, the consigliere of his particular mafia, in fact, his court was anarchy.
Do we go back to the
comparison?
Yeah,
Cameron had one chief of staff for all of his 5.5, 6 years in office. Boris Johnson had three.
Do we go? Does this go back, link back to the Burlington Club and Eton, and that sense of it being basically the government being, or the inner circle of the government being being literally an extension of who you went to school with?
Yeah, the answer. Well, when I started the book, I would have answered that question no. I grew up, and at my early stages of my career, were with Margaret Thatcher. And Margaret Thatcher did not like the Eton, Oxbridge ethos of the Conservative Party. She much preferred your dynamic middle-class businessman making money on the stock exchange, etc., etc. And in my little head, I thought, oh, it's my opportunity now. I don't have the right accent. I've still got traces of my Yorkshire accent. Maybe the world will open up for me. And for a number of years it did. And what I again discovered to my surprise was that we were back in that Eton, Harrow, Oxbridge world again. Half the cabinet having gone to one university and a handful of public schools. It was staggering just how the narrowness of the social background of the people at the top of government.
Cameron might have got away with it, and I'm really sorry to my listeners who are finally, you know, saying, oh, he's just a lefty, but he might, this government might have, you know, Cameron might have continued as Prime Minister. He might have had a glorious reign, except that then things outside their control, you might argue, came into play. Now, I'm talking to you from a studio in southern Spain. So I grew up, you know, I'm 56 years old now. I grew up I still regard myself as a European. I grew up over in Spain. I was of the era of Jacques Delors, EU, etc., you know, Perestroika and Glasnost. So one big European family. And so Cameron has a special place in my heart, as well as many other European, British people who live in Spain, because obviously we had the Brexit, El Brexit, as we call it down here, and the tsunami of paperwork and chaos that hit on that one. And you could say perhaps that he was unwise to hold a referendum and then doubled down on that by, and I was on air at the time and doing some work for the UK broadcasters, and then he came out the front and said thank you very much, you know, goodbye, and thanks for all the fish.
Yes. The Conservative Party throughout this period, and here I refer to the MPs in Parliament and to the members out in the country, became an increasingly unruly mob, massively divided over a number of key issues, and Brexit was definitely one that divided them. And Cameron's problem was he couldn't control his own party. Now, any Prime Minister of the 20th and 21st century who could not control his party was in trouble. I mean, you have to have that solid base back in Westminster supporting you to get your legislation through and to do all the various policy initiatives that you want to do. And Cameron's base in Parliament deserted him. They wanted Brexit. They did not want him to do the deal. It was, you know, if you remember going back at the time, Cameron was off in Brussels trying to do a new deal on the terms of our involvement in the EU, and his party didn't even want him to succeed doing that.
Yeah.
If he had succeeded in doing that, it might have delayed what was probably inevitable, which was a major split within the Tory party, and delayed it for a few months. And, I mean, people blame Cameron for the referendum as if he had a great deal of choice. It seems to me, looking in as an outsider, it wasn't a question of if there was a referendum. It was only a question of when there was a referendum. Otherwise, the Tory party would have been in even more chaos than it subsequently was.
One might argue, though, that referendums are dangerous. If you get my drift, as saying goes, because it life isn't easy as easy as a simple yes. In the majority of times, it's not as easy as a yes or no. And the refrain we've heard ever since then was, "This was not the Brexit I voted for."
Yes, my only problem with that statement is I'm not quite sure what people thought they were voting for. I mean, Brexit was always a slogan, not a policy. And what that slogan actually meant was different things to different people at different times. And when poor old Theresa May was Prime Minister, her major problem was, what the hell is this thing called Brexit? What am I supposed to do? And she had to basically come up with a definition of what it was. She did the Lancaster House speech. It bought her about 15 minutes of peace and quiet. And then they all started fighting over that. Mm. And just in order to get anything done, she retreated to a very small group of people in Number 10, her court. And that court, with great secrecy, came up with their definition of what Brexit was supposed to mean. And it was that definition that people didn't like.
Can we say that Theresa May gets the, you know, because, and again, this also starts something which we've only, obviously, with a new government coming in, but then it starts a succession of conservative party members picking the prime minister, and we go through this long period, which is, I don't think we've had so many prime ministers picked by, you know, but without a general election. But she then has to, if you like, she's in a situation she didn't ask for, but she goes into crisis management mode, i.e. get a small team you can trust. So in retrospect, perhaps she was doing the best of a bad situation.
I mean, I know a number of people who would subscribe to that view, yes. I mean, I think...
Sounds like you don't.
Well, I mean, I think Theresa May was a very, very good departmental minister. She was disciplined, she was organised, she had two good chiefs of staff who worked with her. Things were run, things happened when she was Home Secretary. When she became Prime Minister, she couldn't work in the same way because, you know, as a departmental minister, you can just about be on top of everything. As Prime Minister, it's almost impossible to be on top of everything, because there is just so much that you have to do, and so much of what you have to do is essentially unproductive. I mean, you have to entertain heads of states from other countries. I mean, I know why they do it. I understand the need to do it, but that's 4 hours of that day that you'll never get back. And that was the problem with Theresa May. There was so much to do, and she wanted to be on top of all the detail, and it was almost impossible to be on top of all the detail.
And meanwhile...
So she was, if you like... She was a decent woman. She was, by current standards, certainly, she was an honest politician. But she confronted a situation which was probably irresolvable because the Conservative Party was irreconcilably split. And so no matter what she did, there was always the Remainers who were going to fight her tooth and nail to the end of it. And if she tried to placate the Remainers, then she got Rees-Mogg, the European Research Group, et al., wanting her. And she just sat there in the middle, and it was the old kid's nursery line, you know, the grand old Duke of York. He had 10,000 men. He marched them up to the top of the hill, and he marched them down again. I mean, that's what she was doing. Just marshalling troops around to no great effect, and eventually she just had to give up.
Because in the background, of course, you have these new think tanks, quote unquote, yep, who are throwing in their tuppence worth, and also we have a cast of characters such as Rees-Mogg, who comes, yep, to the fore then. But of course, on the horizon, kicking up storms of dust and sort of shouting from the, you know, shouting from the balcony, is Boris Johnson, who has been mayor of London, who is charismatic, and I will urge people to look for the actual definition of that one. Doesn't mean it's a good or a bad thing, but people seem to like him, and they seem, and he he's got that bluster and bluster, and the next thing we know, there has been yet again a change, if you like, a Knight of the Long Knives, perhaps, and suddenly we find Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and I think it was Nicola Sturgeon, when she found out he'd become Foreign Minister, her reaction was quite something, and what her reaction must have been when he became Prime Minister must have been unprintable.
Yes, well, I mean, Theresa May had this problem that Lyndon Johnson had in the US. Is it better to have people in the tent pissing out or outside the tent pissing in? And she opted for having him in the tent.
Indeed.
I mean, it's a calculation. Toss a coin. Either way, he was trouble. The theory was at least she could control him if he was in the Foreign Office, because she would do most of the major decision making for the Foreign Office and he could go off on jaunts. She underestimated his capacity for gaffes.
It's sort of careful what you wish for, isn't it? I mean, he then got the keys, or he was given the controls, and it was an awful lot harder than sort of quoting Greek and whatever he can bluff and bluster his way. And one might argue that some of the actions he did were illegal and extremely damaging, and basically it took the Conservative Party in a direction that it has never been before. And I'm thinking it's also that talking about long nights of the long nights of the long nights, but when long-standing Conservative MPs like Soames and Ken Clark leave the party, or forced out by the party, and we get this new British.
You can definitely see the hand of Cummings in much of this. Cummings has got a long-standing antipathy to old-style Tories who he just wants nothing to do with and doesn't want them anywhere near the government, and he clearly advised Johnson to have none of his opponents in the cabinet. Now, you can always argue that one of the advantages of having people in the cabinet is it constrains their ability to fight you in public. Cummings didn't buy that, and so they were all kicked out, and much of the unpleasantness, I think, can be down to Cummings. Johnson is actually quite notorious for his inability to confront people. He doesn't like face-to-face conflict. His various advisors and other people around him say that he avoids it. And if anything, he has a habit of saying what people want to hear when he's in face-to-face encounters. Now, that, of course, leads you into all kinds of contradictions.
And of course, as I said
before, was the iron fist.
As I said before with Cameron, he might have got away with it, but for Brexit, Johnson might have still been our Prime Minister, or British Prime Minister, but of course the pandemic hit, and that was not only his reaction to that at the beginning, but we know about Partygate, we know about the alcohol fueled parties and the etc. and one rule for them and not for us, and it really was in a time of crisis. It really was a death knell, wasn't it? It was quite unbelievable.
Well, utterly disgraceful. Let's not mince words. I mean, you know, if you're meant to be the leader of the nation, setting a standard for everybody to follow, helping us through a very difficult time, etc., etc., they did exactly the opposite. And frankly, it's unbelievable that they thought that this was a reasonable way to behave. There's a wonderful little story that I like, told by one of the former cabinet secretaries, who said, "I had done this little thought experiment. I sit in my office and I think of Margaret Thatcher upstairs in her room working late night on her papers, and she was famous for working incredibly long hours, listening to disco music coming from a room downstairs." And of course, the implication of telling that story is there's absolutely no way in which Thatcher would have tolerated that. 5 minutes after she heard the music,
Can you imagine, Mark? Yes. Unbelievable. If you're sitting there, you know, shaking your little stuff, going, "I hope nobody's filming this, ha ha," and then you hear, the thud of the Iron Lady's footsteps coming down the hall.
Her self-discipline was renowned. She expected the same discipline from everybody around her. They would never have thought do it. They would know that this was not the kind of behaviour that was expected in Number 10. But let's not focus too much on Partygate, reprehensible though it may be. The point is, Partygate is merely the worst example of a recurring pattern of behaviour within Number 10. I mean, there are lots and lots of instances of Boris Johnson condoning things that nobody else would have condoned. The most famous one, again, towards the end, was Pincher.
Yeah.
Where, you know, well, eventually the House of Commons Privileges Committee decided that Johnson had misled Parliament. So all those people who said that Johnson had lied, which he had vehemently denied for months on repeated occasions in the House of Commons, were vindicated, as we were shown that Johnson really only gave you the information that suited him at that point in time. And he would invent some story around it, which led him to believe that he was telling the truth, even though he wasn't. I mean, in the book, I call him a fabulist. He tells fables, and he believes his own fables, but they are fables, and they bear very little relationship to the facts of the situation.
Okay, here's the thing, then. Johnson, in this particular case, is he showing a misguided loyalty to somebody he's known in government and on a personal level for a long time? So, if you like, it's a miscalculation based on a friendship, or is he again just being a fabulist, or is he just being completely inappropriate to the highest office in the land?
Well, it certainly was the latter in terms of inappropriate behaviour. But the other point about it, of course, is if you think about matters of personal morality, Johnson is on very shaky ground to be making pronouncements about how other people ought to conduct their lives. I mean, in terms of, for example, affairs, remember he was initially sacked from Howard's shadow cabinet because he lied about his mistress.
Yes.
And I mean, the well-documented trail of women in his life, of whom Jennifer Akuri was the latest one, who had surfaced yet again in his life. If you remember, the allegation there was that it was sex for contracts, that she was his mistress and he favoured her in awarding contracts from the London government.
And then when the end comes, though, it gives, you know, and I don't like to quote Game of Thrones. Well, I do like to quote Game of Thrones because they're circling, aren't they? And the four, you've got people like Gove, you know, you've got Braverman is you know, the far right. You've got Patel and Braverman, and they're all making noises as well. And then when the House of Cards starts to fall, it goes with incredible speed. And I just remember that, you know, the last week, stroke 48, and then that incredible 24 hours where literally. Every hour, people were resigning from the government. It was quite something.
Oh, yes, yes. And I mean, the accounts of how they were trying to find people to fill the ministries that had just been vacated. I mean, they didn't even have enough bodies to replace ministers who'd resigned.
So,
I mean, if there was somebody who were even remotely defensible for the job, they didn't want it because they knew they'd probably have it for 48 hours.
Yeah, so poison chalice.
Yes.
What are you hoping that people will learn from your book?
I guess it sounds terribly prosaic. I apologise in advance that actually we expect our politicians to be decent human beings. Because for much of this period, a great many of them were not. They, I call them knaves, the old Shakespearean word.
Knaves, wonderful, yes.
And they, far too many of them were knaves. Once upon a yesterday, we thought the thick of it was actually a comedy. It was a comedy of exaggeration, where he took certain parts of people's behaviour in government and exaggerated it for comic purposes. I think far too many MPs and ministers, etc., think this is how they ought to behave. That actually, this is not this is real life imitating art and taking on behaviour which was meant to be funny and satirical and basically outrageous, and treating it as this is how we ought to behave on an everyday basis. And I'd like to see our politicians behave on an everyday basis in a decent way. I mean, one of the whole tragedy of the children, the Taylor Swift dance class, etc., is the way that it's degenerated into these riots. But at the time, what I thought was really rewarding about it, it also made you smile, was the way people mucked in to help out.
Yeah.
They cleared up the streets, they helped the children, they brought the flowers, and what you saw was everyday people behaving decently. I'd like to see our everyday politicians behaving decently as a matter of routine, not some kind of great sacrifice that they make. Oh, I suppose now we better... it's so hard. No, it shouldn't be hard. This should be why you're in office, to be a decent human being helping your fellow citizens. And it doesn't seem to be the way. If anything, I would say that self-interest predominated.
The book is called, I could talk to you for a little bit, but I'm about to run out of time. The book is called The Prime Ministerial Court, Conservative Statecraft in the 21st Century. It's by Professor Rod Rhodes, who's speaking to you today. And you'll be able to order the book via our own virtual bookstore. Professor, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Oh, delighted you wanted to speak to me.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.